Hello, hello, and welcome to Her Music Academia, the podcast. I'm your host, Lydia Bangura. This is the show where I talk all about music. So I talk about all the things in music that I'm interested in. As a PhD student in music theory at the University of Michigan, I talk all about music performance, music education, music production, music analysis. And I do it with my friends and my colleagues who also are doing really interesting stuff in music. Today, my guest is Natalie Kraft. We met when we were both studying at Northern Arizona University. And so we talk all about our experience there. We talk about her experience now as a music teacher, K through sixth grade. Also, we talk about how she's streaming on Twitch now, which is literally the coolest thing I've ever heard. That's so exciting. She's actually an affiliate now, so make sure you go follow her on Twitch. I can put the link for that in the show notes. And we talk all about the Goldberg Variations, which is a piece by Bach that he wrote for harpsichord. Without further ado, here's our conversation. Today, my guest is Natalie Kraft. Natalie, how are you?
I'm great. I'm so excited. Literally, I've been so excited for this podcast for so long. Like, you messaged me and I was like, oh my God. And now I'm here, so I'm like, yes. So I'm very excited.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on. And that's funny because when I messaged Natalie, she was like, me, a star? Like, what would I talk about on the pod? And I'm like, please, everybody's musical career is interesting because they're so different, because we all take such different paths to get there. So even if you go to the same school as somebody, you major in the same thing, you know, your careers could end up being completely different and you just don't really know how it's going to turn out because music careers are so volatile. So it's so interesting and valuable, you know, always to hear about people's musical experiences, their backgrounds and how they end up, you know, getting to the paths that they do. So let's get into it and let's start off with your musical history and background. So your early experiences in music, when you started playing music or singing music, and then how you ended up at NAU.
So this starts off with my mother, as any music story does. It starts off with my mother. She had me when she was, I think, 26, and she told my dad, I'm going crazy. I'm getting baby brain. I need to do something. And so my dad got her a violin and got her set up with violin lessons, right? But I was a baby, I was an infant. So she brought me to these lessons, like her very first music lessons. I've been there since a baby infant, you know, and then
she started playing violin at 26.
Yes, she started playing violin at 26 and I came as a baby to her lessons.
Oh my God. Yeah. What a meet cute for music. I love that.
It was a good time. And so we were living in California at the time, and when I was three, I started off taking Suzuki violin lessons because her teacher was a Suzuki teacher. So I did a year of Suzuki violin lessons. I have zero memory of it whatsoever. Did not stick because I was three. But then we moved out to Arizona. And I don't know why, but six-year-old me was like, Mom, I want to learn how to play the clarinet. And my mom was like, okay, that's fine, but not until you do 2 years of piano lessons first. And so when I was seven, they signed me up for piano lessons. I did it for 3 years. Took up the clarinet for fifth grade band because that's when I was able to take up clarinet. So I got to the clarinet, and then high school happened and I moved up to Prescott and I was like, I don't want to do clarinet anymore. I still took piano lessons, but then I was like, I want to learn the viola instead because I know the treble clef and I know the bass clef. I want to learn the alto clef, but I know I'm not going to work on it myself unless I have a reason to. And if I play the instrument that plays it, I will learn it. So then in high school, I played the viola. And I'm still taking piano lessons throughout this whole time, right? Like, I think it took a couple years off at some point. I think this is really bad, but I think when I was in eighth grade, my parents took away piano lessons from me because I was such a brat. I had such a bad attitude as a little preteen that they took it away from me. So that was a forced sabbatical, that one. But so that was a whole thing. And then junior, senior year, the church that I went to, they found out I could play piano. And the church director, like the music director, was like, you want to play for the church? You'll get paid. And I was like, heck yeah. So I did that for a year. And then she's like, okay, Natalie, you can still play for us, but we're not paying you until you do it on the organ. So I had to learn how to play the organ to get paid by this church, which I don't think is an actual thing. I think that's just what she used to convince me to play the organ.
You play organ as well? Oh my God.
I do, yes. So I've stopped a couple of times here and there. But the only reason why was because the church I was at was like, you can't get paid until you do the organ, right? And so senior year of high school, our school counselor, my high school was very small for reference. So I think my graduating class was like 48. And so the school counselor got all of us in the library, which is at the time in the garage of this house on our school property. It was a weird one. It's weird. We live, it's like out in the middle of nowhere. But he got all of the seniors in the library and was like, seniors, y'all got to figure it out. Do you need to take tests? Do you need to do entrance stuff? Like, what do you need to bring for like orientation? Like, figure this out. And I was like, oh, I should figure it out. And so I like on a whim decided to apply to the NAU School of Music because I was like, ASU is too hot. U of A is too hot and too far away. And NAU has a much nicer climate. And so I auditioned for the NAU School of Music on a whim. Was not very, my audition was rough. It was a rough time. I hate performing. Like, I'm not a performer person, like a performer, pianist? I don't even know. I don't, I can't perform to save my life. Let's put it that way. I cannot do it. And so I auditioned, and I think I went in for a performance major, but I think on like my form, I was like, I don't really know what I want to do, but I want a music degree. And so the piano faculty was like, you have experience in other instruments, so just go into music education. And I was like, all right, that sounds good to me. And so I got assigned my music ed degree, basically.
That's how that happened.
That's how that happened, yeah. So yeah, that's how I got that degree, and I stuck with it. Freshman year, I had a meltdown. I was like, I can't do this. And then I went to my English class. I was like, never mind, this is stupid. I need to only take music classes until I die. And so I just stuck with the degree.
Wow.
So that's how that happened.
Now, okay. Now,
yes. I am not one of those cutesy I'm not one of those cutesy music teachers where I'm like, I wanted to be a music teacher since I was 7. Like, I wish I was that, but I'm not that. So
this is fascinating. So you just came to NAU like, I don't know, but I just want a music degree.
Yeah, and, basically.
And you stuck with that rather than like a BA?
Yes, because I thought music ed at least would be useful. Like, I can teach and you'll always need teachers. That's what I knew that right away. You know, I was like, if I go through the ed degree, I'll always have a guaranteed job. There's always going to be a need for teachers no matter where I go. You know,
that is fair.
And then I thought, well, maybe if I get good enough, I can still, maybe if I got good enough and I enjoyed it, I could go do like the performance thing. Because you can perform with an ed degree. You can't necessarily like teach with a performance degree as well. You know?
Right.
So,
right.
Or like not, yeah, if that makes sense. So right. That's why I stuck with it.
Interesting. And it's also interesting that, first of all, I did not know that you play like 12 instruments. Cool. Second of all, it's interesting that as piano kind of became this thread through your musical upbringing, but you never were like, I want to be a pianist?
No. So if you had asked high school me like junior year what I wanted to be, I would have told you I want to be a pediatrics PA. Like I always knew that I wanted to work with kids because I love working with kids. They just, they're very honest for the most part. They're just, they're innocent in like a very, you know, childlike way because they're children, obviously. So it's just, I don't know. They're easy to work with. They're fun to work with and they're interesting. And so I was like, I want to be a pediatrics PA. And then I took like a course on like pre-med stuff. And I was like, oh, this is a lot of paperwork and it's a lot of math and I hate math. I hate math more than I love kids. So I was like, I'm not going into pediatrics PA. And so the music ending ended up working out anyways, you know.
Wow. Okay.
I was very much like, I want to go into science. But I think when I look back on it, I think it was more like I wanted to appease my dad. You know, I'm the oldest daughter. So it was very much like, I want to do what I can to make my dad happy. And he wanted like I don't know if he wanted an oldest son, but that was kind of the vibe I got, was like, he wanted someone like more masculine from his kids, you know? And so I was like, oh, I'll go into science, be like doctor. And then I was like, oh, it's kind of dumb. I don't like it. And then I don't even care.
I totally feel you. You know, my parents are immigrants from Sierra Leone. And so there was a very, very heavy narrative of, you know, we did not come to this country all the way from Sierra Leone for you to be a musician. Like, it was very
I get it. Yeah,
you know, the pressure to be a doctor was very strong. Sorry, Mom, love you.
Oh, yeah.
But I am going to be a doctor of music theory.
Something. You'll have to call me doctor, but I'm not going to save your life. At the end of
the day. I will be getting a doctorate. We're close. We're getting closer. But okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. And how would you describe your experience at Northern Arizona?
It was very tumultuous for me. It was a lot. Like I'm an adult now, right? I live on my own. I've got a big girl job. And I'm like, I'm at the point now where I come home from work and I don't want to do anything else. And I don't leave once I'm home. And I'm like, how did I manage my schedule at NAU? Like, I think back to it and I'm like, junior, senior year, my schedule was I show up to the news building at 7:30 and I don't go home until 10 p.m. And I was just gone all day. it was like an intense schedule. It's very insane. And I took on a lot more than I should have. And I just never quite figured out like my practice and my time management, not until like junior, senior year. And it felt like I kind of wasted my first 2 years. Like I could have done better if I had a better grasp of that earlier, but I just didn't, you know, if that makes sense. Cause I also never went in with that mentality. Like I never took music seriously until I got to college basically. But like,
wow. Yeah.
You know, cause it was always a very casual thing for me. And I was like, I liked it. And it was like what I did when I got stressed out or when I was like frustrated or didn't want to do something. Like I went to piano and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, this is, I have to do this now.
Right. Yeah. You know, that is a really drastic change. You know,
it is very drastic. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I grew up playing viola. I played viola for like 10 or 12 mm-hmm. years and then switched to voice when I got to university, but I was very used to practicing hard. I was very used to like, you know, sitting down. Yeah. You know, sitting down, being serious. You know, I always knew that I wanted to be a professional musician, and I did you know, come into college with the intention of being a performer, you know. So I had figured out some of that discipline as I was growing up. But you know, what I will say about NAU, and this goes, you know, across the board in music education, especially in the conservatory model, right, is that they train you to be a good musician, right, to know about the niches in your particular field. Right. I don't know that they train you with skills to be like, you know, an adult or, you know, skills, right, for functioning outside of your identity as a musician. Right? So it's really, really paramount that you practice and that you're familiar with all the literature and that you're taking all those methods classes and that you're doing all that. But, you know, like I look back, I still find it really, really baffling that no one ever once was like, you know what, you should take an African-American history course. You should take a women's and gender studies course. You should take like, you know, that stuff was never really prompted.
Oh yeah. I've always said that if I could go back and change one thing, it was that I would get an art history minor. Because I took an art history class the same semester I took music history. And I was like, this is the perfect world. Like the art history, the art behind it was like, oh, this is so incredibly interesting. I love it. And like, I still love art to this day. You know, and I'm like, if I could go back, I would go back and get the art history degree. Cause I love music history and I love art history. Like I have no problem doing all the research and getting into it. And like, I love it. It's my thing. But if I could go back, I would go back and get art history.
No, you know? that is amazing. Right. Because I also, you know, struggle again, and this is the result of music education, struggle to see how music connects to other art forms, like visual art, like poetry, spoken art, right. Like, so I feel like we were in some ways kind of deprived from experiencing the rest of the humanities in a way that I'm just now starting to reckon with as I have, you know, more electives in my doctoral degree, right? So now I'm getting so now I'm minoring in African American studies and diaspora studies.
That's so good.
Which has been really valuable for me. Yeah. But I wish someone earlier had been like, you don't know who Toni Morrison is, you should take a class. Like you don't, you know, like somebody should have been like, wait, Lydia's not a conscious adult, like we need to help her, like but instead it was just like, I'm taking all these diction classes, I'm taking all the language classes, I'm taking which I understand. I understand, like trying to drill expertise in such a niche field, but I wish that I had someone had encouraged me to like read, because I did not read until this degree. Like this year, I was not reading books. I was not like Lydia was practicing, doing recitals, being in operas. All that is great, but like I wish somebody had.
Okay, this is totally I mean, it's kind of related, but I still think of your Papagena performance every once in a while, and I'm like, oh, that was so good. I still think about that sometimes. I'm like, oh, that was so good.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And I still think about that bomb ass recital that you gave when you were a junior. Oh. Yo.
Oh, that was very stressful. I'll never do it again. I'm never giving another recital ever again.
Are you joking? Listeners. She's depriving us.
Maybe one day when I feel more confident. But
right now, listeners, you can look in the show notes and find the GoFundMe for Natalie's next recital.
That's so good. I will have to say, the one good thing about my degree is that, because I was a music ed person, right, and it was a miserable time. Senior year, I don't know if you knew, but we had to do practicum.
Sure.
Right. Yep. And our NAU had a weird deal where us music ed majors could only get our practicum hours from schools down in the valley, from like one particular school district, right? And so every other Friday, this group of music ed people would have to wake up at like 4 or 5 in the morning and head down to Phoenix at 5:30 in the morning. We spent all day there and then come back up. And some of us, not me, had to go back and do orchestra rehearsals that Friday, right? Because we would be back by like 5 or 6, right? And so I'm like, thank God that wasn't me. But like, we had to do that, right? But because of that, I remember I was like, I'm so stressed out that I can't sit here in my stress anymore. And that's when I started baking. And so every Wednesday or Thursday night, I would start baking cookies or muffins so I can bring it to our practicum trips. And I would just be the person who brought breakfast to this caravan of music ed people. So now because of it, I bake really consistently. Like I just made focaccia today earlier and I just had some before we got onto this. And I was like, this is a good time. This is a good idea. So I think that's the one good thing about my personality that's changed is that I've evolved into being a part-time baker.
What a fantastic coping mechanism. Oh my gosh.
It's a great coping mechanism.
That is so lovely. Wow. I love that.
That's been the one good thing.
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, overall, I had a really great time at NAU. I'm glad that I went. And mm-hmm. I really appreciated studying with Christine, studying with Dr. Chang.
Oh, like, I miss Christine. Yeah. I miss Dr. Chang.
Christine, Dr. Chang, come on the podcast, please. Pretty please. I would love it. And again, this isn't necessarily an NAU problem. It is a problem with music education at large, is that we are insisting that it's more important that students practice for 4 hours a day than them becoming, they're socially conscious people, socially politically conscious people that are aware of history, that are aware of other people's experiences. Mm-hmm. Where I was just like, I know all the diction.
I get that.
You know, that might also have been a result of like being in Arizona as well, which is, you know, pretty white.
That's rough. It's very white.
So
it's very white.
Yeah. So, you know, but you know, overall, I had a great time in NAU, and I think it did prepare me for the work that I did in my master's, kind of in the way that it was supposed to. But you know, it certainly wasn't perfect. So let's talk about your experience now with what you're doing now. So now you are teaching.
Yes, I teach preschool through sixth grade general music at elementary school.
Oh, bless you. Oh my God.
Yeah. So for reference, obviously COVID hit like March of 2020, right? So I was still at NAU on campus at the time. That was my last semester on campus. Oh, wow. So I had to finish my last semester on campus during COVID online. And then I had to do my entire student teaching during COVID too, which was nutso.
Yeah.
It was bizarre. So like I start because for my degree, you have to do elementary and secondary placement, right? So you're secondary ed major, so you have to do both. And so my elementary placement was at a school district and was at a school in Chandler, in the Chandler School District. But at the time when I first got there, first quarter, they were entirely online. So I got to do everything at home in Prescott, my student teaching in Prescott while they were doing stuff in Chandler. And then the last 3 weeks, I had to live with my grandmother in Sun City and just commute to Chandler for 3 weeks. Right? Because they went back in school.
Wow.
Right? So it was a weird time there. And then I finished up the last half of the semester back in Prescott at Prescott High School with Mr. Bradstreet. And they were still doing COVID things, but they were doing it differently. So they were doing like a hybrid thing where like last names A through K came in Monday, Wednesday, and then the rest of the alphabet came in Tuesday, Thursday, and then Friday was online, which like in theory makes sense if you're like a core class, like if you're math or English writing, whatever. But as like a performance arts class, when like half the ensemble is there, and for whatever godforsaken reason, A through K has all the saxophones, and then L through Z only has like one or whatever, it like really messes up the music. So I never got the full experience of a full high school ensemble because we were just always half and half, and it was just very skewed. And so that was my experience during high school. So it was very bizarre. I just never had like the proper student teaching experience.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah,
like I didn't have to do marching band or anything.
Wow.
Thank God, I hate marching band. That was the only good thing. I didn't have to do marching band. I hate marching band and I didn't have to do that. God bless.
Wow. That is a really strange experience.
It was very weird.
Do you have anything from when you were teaching solely online, any experiences or skills that you feel like you developed during that you're taking into your in-person teaching?
I would say I don't know. Cause I feel like teaching online is just totally different. Mm. When you're online, it's a lot easier to control kids' behaviors. Cause you can just mute them or turn their camera off. You know, you can do that kind of stuff. So you don't have to see them or hear them or whatever. You can kick kids out if they're being inappropriate for whatever reason, but like in person, not as much. I think the thing that really changed my perspective in terms of how I approach teaching was with online stuff. I focused a lot on trying to build a relationship with my kids because it's like they'll only ever see me through a screen. And I need them to understand that I'm a real person and I know that they're a real person and that we can still have a connection even online. So that aspect has been brought into my teaching. So I make it a point to get really close with my students, you know, professionally, so that way we have that close relationship. So that's been like the one thing. Teaching wise, pedagogy wise, probably not as much.
Okay.
Yeah. But maybe that's just me being bad at it, but I have no idea. It was just hard.
I mean, I doubt that, but okay. So before we talk about the Bach, we have to touch on listeners. Natalie literally dropped the biggest reveal of my life. I almost fell out of my chair. Natalie has been streaming on Twitch, playing piano on Twitch. We have to talk about this because so about a year ago, it still doesn't fully make sense to me because I've never fully identified as a gamer. For the listeners who aren't familiar with Twitch, Twitch is like a streaming platform where people will live stream themselves doing things. It's very often associated with gaming. So people will live stream themselves playing video games or computer games. But people do a bunch of different stuff on Twitch. People just talk on Twitch. People do their makeup on Twitch. People cook on Twitch. People do a bunch of different things. It is mostly associated with gaming, but there are categories where people do a lot of different things. You know, we love a hot tub stream. Just kidding. But yeah, so I started watching Twitch like a year ago, and I think it was because, you know, I've never identified as a gamer. I've never really had a video game console. Like when I was growing up, we had a PlayStation 2 for like a year, and then we ended up selling it. So we just never really were into video games and never really got it. And then there was a brief moment in high school. I had some friends that got me a Nintendo DS, which was very nice of them. And so I had maybe 2 years of like some Pokemon, some Kingdom Hearts, some Animal Crossing. And that's as close as it got.
Do you want to know how many hours I have on Animal Crossing?
Oh boy.
Totally related. Last I checked, I have 790 hours on Animal Crossing.
Let's go.
Because I have the Switch Lite, so I got New Horizons.
There we go.
And so I would just play it for hours on end.
So, you know, I never really identified with being a gamer, but in the past year I started watching people play games on Twitch, and I think it was the live aspect that was really appealing to me. You know, during the pandemic where there's been, you know, obviously a lack of live in-person events like concerts and things like that, it was something that was interactive that I could still participated with at home, and so I really liked that live aspect. And so I started watching Twitch like a year ago, so I'm shocked and so excited to hear that you've started to stream on Twitch. So what has that been like?
It's been interesting. You know, I did it because, so like a lot of times when you see the music streams on Twitch, it's a lot of like song requests, right? So it's like classical musicians or violinists or pianists who are like really good at what it is that they do. And they're like, oh yeah, I also have like this huge song list of things that I have memorized, like requested in the chat, and I'll play it for you. Right. So it's very viewer interactive. And so I was like, well, I'm not going to be able to do that because I'm not that kind of, I'm a kind of pianist where I memorize it, I perform it, and then it's gone. Like I don't need it anymore. So we're done. So I don't have all these songs like memorized, like backed up in my brain or whatever. But I was like, I need to practice and I want to practice, but I have a hard time practicing on my own without that aspect of the practice rooms, where like I miss being able to like see people in the practice rooms and talk to them and take a break or like hear other things going on. And so obviously the solution was to just use my phone, and rather than have it be a distraction, have it be a tool so I don't use it as much, right, by streaming myself on Twitch. And so I stream myself pretty consistently on Twitch 4 days a week. 3 of those days are music streams, so it's just me practicing music. And then one of those days is me lesson planning, because I do have to take time outside of like my work week to lesson plan after school. And so it's just like a little just chatting stream. People just come in and talk, they say hi, things like that, you know, that's what it is. So it's just me practicing, and then they, you know, people chat and I get to say hi or whatever, you know, that's what we do.
this is phenomenal. I'm obsessed with this idea. It is amazing. I only follow a couple people that do music streams. But normally, like you said, it is kind of that like, oh, request a song and I'll play it. That sort of thing being interactive.
Yeah. Mine's very much like a practice room thing. Like, you want to see someone struggle? Come on. It's me struggling. You want to hear really nitty gritty metronome practice? It's me. I'm doing it right now.
I love it. Okay. So let's talk about this, because I have a fun story that's a bit similar. So I joined a Discord. So this was about 2 years ago now. I joined a Discord, which, for the listeners, if you don't know what Discord is, how do you describe Discord? It's an app with a bunch of different channels in it. And
yes. Like-minded communities built.
Right. It's kind of like Slack, but like for
casual and social friends and things. Yeah.
I'm not explaining this well, listeners. I'm sorry. It's like Slack, but it builds like social communities. So there could be a Discord channel that's surrounded around like the Italian language, where you can go and practice Italian with people that speak Italian.
I am in one of those Discord servers. Yeah.
There we go. Or, you know, a Discord for a book club that you're in or something like that. Yeah. So it's kind of a similar setup to Slack. And basically I joined this Discord server called Study Together. And listeners, I would really recommend this. If you are a student, it is a great.
I'm in that one.
There we go.
I'm literally in that one. Yes, it's a good one. I love their. Oh,
it is
those
a
are good.
Great resource. It's a great resource. So basically, it's like an online kind of library setting where there are a bunch of different video channels. There are voice channels where you can go in. And you study, right? So whatever you're working on, there are students of all levels. There are students from like middle school, high school, all the way through PhDs.
PhD people,
and people just go on, turn on their camera, and they study. And it's been a really helpful resource during the pandemic if you have a hard time focusing, studying by yourself, which I really struggle with. I really like a library setting or a cafe setting to study. And so obviously during the height of the pandemic, that was, you know, unsafe. And so
not an option.
So, you know, we're all stuck indoors. So I found it really helpful to have kind of a virtual space where students from all over the world, this is an international server, students from all over the world, you can turn on your camera or not. You can just go into a channel that's voice only. You can, there are channels where you're all working on a timer, like using the Pomodoro method where you'll work together for 25 minutes and then take 5 minute breaks, or work for 50 minutes, take 10 minute breaks. You can talk to people on their breaks. And oh, where are you from? I'm from the US. Oh, I'm from the Netherlands, or whatever. And it was a really, really cool thing. Now, during this time, I was taking lessons with Dr. Chang, actually. So I was taking some piano lessons with her. And so I had to practice, and that's what I did while I was using Study Together. Is I would go on and then I would set up my computer by my piano, and then I would practice piano, and it was so awesome. And sometimes people would ask me to unmute, like, oh, I would love to listen to you, like, while you're, and I was like, oh, this is so weird, but it did kind of scratch that performance itch in my brain, as far as like, oh, it's keeping me focused. Oh, I know people are watching me, people are listening to me. And so even if I was just playing scales or whatever, like, it was really, really helpful to just know that other people could see me. And it really, it really kind of satisfied my performance itch at the time. Cause again, I've always been a performance major. Like, that's what I love to do. And obviously the pandemic was devastating for everybody and for performers in a particular way. So it was really, really helpful. So that's kind of what I was using that server for. I still use it from time to time. For reading and things like that, but it's so funny that you were like, I just started streaming on Twitch and that really helped me stay focused. And it was like, oh my gosh, I was literally doing the same thing on this Discord server. So I would really recommend it. Listeners, if you are a student and you need help like studying while you're at home, really check out this Discord server, Study Together. Anybody can use it if you have a Discord account, and it's a really valuable resource.
It's like really impressively set up too. Like, they, these people really thought of like everything.
The mods are like incredible. Truly,
honestly, they thought about everything putting into that one. Oh my God.
Okay, so let's pivot to talking about the Goldberg variations. And let's start off with why you picked them. How did you become familiar with this piece?
Senior year, I started doing this thing where every, it couldn't have been senior year because I didn't have a bathtub. When was it? I must have heard it sometime senior year, right? And so I listened to it senior year. I'm like, this is good Bach work, right? Like, I loved Bach. And so I remember junior year, I started listening to the Netherlands Bach Society YouTube. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen it. High quality stuff. I love their channel. But I listened to them really consistently, and they came out with a recording, that one of the recordings that I sent you, and I was like, this is good. I like this Bach piece. This is good, right? And I remember talking to Dr. Scott after my junior recital. I was like, oh, I kind of want to learn that. And he's like, Natalie, these are a lot of variations. Don't do it. I was like, all right, that's fine. And then I started this thing when I left NEU, where I started taking a bath every Sunday, and I would just listen to all this music while I'm in the bath, right? Because that's the best time to listen to music that you haven't heard, right? It's in the bath. And so after like 6 months of listening to the Bach cello suites, like for 6 months straight, every week I'm listening to the Bach cello suites in the bath, I was like, I need to change it up. And so I came back to the Bach Goldberg variations, and I'm like, oh my God, I forgot how good this is. And I just became obsessed with it. So I've been obsessed with it now for like at least a year and a half, you know? Mm-hmm. I think part of it for me is like knowing the background of it too, and how it's set up versus other pieces has made it really interesting to me. But yeah, I'm like obsessed with it.
Okay, interesting. So you haven't played this?
No, so I just finished learning the aria. I've just learned the aria. And I'm trying to decide if I want to learn all of the variations, because I'm like, I have time. I don't have a time crunch. I'm on a timeline, so I could just learn all of it. I could just learn a few of them, because there's a few that I really like. So I've learned the aria, though. It's a really beautiful aria, you know, and I've just been listening to the variations all the time. So I'm like, I might learn it. I don't know. I have to decide.
Okay, yeah. Interesting. Yeah, because I was like, oh, mm-hmm. I'm interested in her perspective if she's played this piece or not, or if it just appeals to her. So how has your experience playing it been so far? Do you find it fun to play?
Yeah, and so here's my thing about it. So I don't know if you know much about the Weld Semper Clavier, but that was kind of written, Bach wrote it as like, oh yeah, this is for like young musicians or musicians who are coming back to music and want to study the keyboard more, right? So you wrote it for that, but the Goldberg variations weren't written for like an academic purpose. Right. Do you know the backstory of the Goldberg variations?
A little bit, but please enlighten me and the listeners.
Okay, so I'm going to butcher these pronunciations because I don't speak German, my bad. But the story goes, in 1740-ish, 1741, Bach is approached by this guy named Count Kaiserling, however you say it. And he comes to Bach and he's like, I have insomnia and I'm sad. Can you write me some music that's going to help me go to sleep and also make me feel joyful? And Bach was like, okay, I got you. And so he writes the Goldberg variation. He writes the aria and the 30 variations, and he ended with the aria again. And they named it the Goldberg variation after one of the Count's keyboardists, Johann Gottlieb, or Gottlieb, however you say it, Goldberg. So Johann Goldberg is the first keyboardist to perform it. And so they call it the Goldberg variations, right? And for a while, people kind of, I think if I remember correctly, out in the public, it's assumed that Goldberg wrote it. But then in 1802, some classical or some musicologist or whatever was like, oh, actually Bach wrote this, right? And so it goes back to Bach and everything. But they wrote it, and I don't know if the story is true, because scholars are like, well, we don't know if Johann Goldberg actually performed it. He was only a 14-year-old kid at the time. We don't know if he was a prodigy or not. And then they also say that the Goldberg variations, when he finished it, the Count was so pleased that he paid Bach in like a goblet of gold. And that's the most money Bach ever made off of one piece, which is the goblet of gold payment that he got from the Goldberg variations, right? So for me, the intent behind it isn't as academic as it is just like, you know, a peaceful, emotional sort of like just cause piece. You know what I mean? It seems much more intimate because the idea is that it's written behind for one person for that specific purpose.
Sure.
If that makes sense.
So do you find that people, like teachers, are kind of employing this piece for the pedagogical aspects?
Yeah, I think so. You don't hear a lot of people perform it is also my thing. You know, and I think part of it's because there's this understanding that if you do the Goldberg variations, you do all of them. Right, which like depending on if you take the repeats or not, depending on how fast you take it, right, it can be anywhere between like 45 minutes to an hour and a half.
Right.
You know what I mean? But like the idea is he has the repeats, you play the repeats, and it's about an hour and a half. Right. Unless you're Glenn Gould, then it's like an hour, you know? We don't talk about Glenn Gould. I don't.
Interesting.
This idea.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so that's what appeals to me about it, is that it's not as academic, which is why the recordings I send you and the recordings that you find are just so vastly different across the board, I think.
Yes.
This particular piece compared to other Bach pieces, this has like the most variation it, between performers, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
So on that note, let's take a listen to, we can play a few minutes of the aria, of mm-hmm. the different recordings that you sent me, and then we can talk about them, because you're right, they're so varied. I was like, what is going on here?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
So first let's listen to, sorry if I'm pronouncing this incorrectly, Wan Shang's recording mm-hmm. of Goldberg Variations, the aria. Mm-hmm. Recording is so beautiful and delicate. I love it so much. What is it about this recording that you particularly like?
I feel like you're right, it is very delicate, but I also feel like it's a little more emotional than some recordings I hear. So I listened to the Anders Schiff recording quite a bit, right? And Anders Schiff is very, like, I feel like he's very metronomical, right? But granted, it's like a 2003 recording, so it's, you know, earlier in his earlier before, right? But I feel like with the Shang recording, it's like I can hear his expression and his motivation behind it more so than Bach's, which I can appreciate. But it's not so grossly over that you don't get Bach's intention either. So I find it's a really good balance of slightly more performer, less Bach, but still enough Bach where it's there, if that makes sense.
Okay.
You know? So I feel like sometimes people take it too literally, like, it must sound like Bach. And I'm like, well, I don't know. Could sound like you too.
Right.
And that's I like that recording for that reason.
Right.
You know, it's very distinctly his recording, their recording.
Totally. That's something that we've talked a lot about, Emily and I, on the Theory Club, as far as staying true to the composer's intentions, whatever that means, right? And that's really difficult when there are so many different opinions about Bach's intentions or Mozart's intentions or whoever, that there are authority figures really on that. Too.
Bach is tricky for pianists because we're playing it on a piano, but he wrote this originally for a harpsichord. So then it's the question of, do you play it as if it's written for piano, or do you play it as if it's written for a harpsichord on a piano? You know, and both of those are very different sounds.
Sure.
You know?
Totally.
But I like that recording. It's nice because it's like, it sounds like it's meant for piano, but, you know, it's good.
Totally. Now, this is another thing that I was thinking about as I was listening to a bunch of different recordings. Again, we'll listen to a few more and we can compare and contrast. But I kept seeing kind of a thread in all of the YouTube comments about, like, this person, like, I just love this recording because they got the Bach swing, or this person, they understand, like, the Bach intuition, or they have the Bachian, like, and it was like, wait, what are people talking about? Again, it's this, like, composer's intentions is really murky, like, very abstract way of talking about what Bach would have wanted, or how someone masters, quote unquote, playing Bach, or do you know, can we decode, like, what these people are trying to say when someone's like, yeah, they've just got that Bach swing, you know? Like, it's like when people say, like, I know as a singer, like, people talk a lot about the Mozartian line. Like, you have to be able to sing this Mozartian, and it's like, are we just talking about legato, or are we what? Right, like, what's going on? Like, what? So, like, can we? It's like this weird, abstract, you know, elitist kind of way of talking about, right? Like, people who have mastered the masters. So, do you have thoughts about like this language? Did people use that while you were in school?
For sure. And, like, I get it to an extent. Like, as a pianist, you wouldn't play Bach the way you play Mozart, the way you play Beethoven, the way you play Chopin. Like, you wouldn't play all those people the same way.
Sure, there are style differences.
Like, you wouldn't play Chopin.
Yeah.
yeah, there are style differences. And I think at base level, you do need that, right? Like, I'm not going to sit here and play the Goldberg Variations like it's a Beethoven piece. Like, I can't, right? You're like, I just couldn't do it. And I feel like that's mostly what people are referring to.
Okay.
It's like, oh, if you get like that period style. But like, you're going to tell me and listen, maybe this is bad of me to say, but you can't sit there and tell me that Haydn and Mozart are so very distinctly different, that there's a Mozart swing versus a Haydn swing, you know, or there's a Handel swing versus a Bach swing. Like, I mean, maybe there's slight differences, but it's not like so overtly like necessary to get that I feel like it needs to happen. Now, if you say they have the Chopin touch versus the Rachmaninoff touch, I can believe that.
Sure.
So let's get to the Romantic period. I can get behind that. But when it's like, we're up to classical, I'm like, there are just some unspoken rules that every composer follows, every performance follows, you know, between Bach and Baroque and classical music. Like, that's, I think that's more what it is.
Sure. And it's this interesting thing as far as like practice versus natural talent, like when somebody's just got it, right? Like, oh, that person just knows Bach and has just got it. And you're like, what? Yeah. Like, says who, right? According to what?
Yeah.
Like, it's this very, it just strikes me as so,
it's a kind of pedestal behavior, you know, like weird composer worship, which like, I get it, but also it's like, they're dead. Like, what are they going to do right
Thank
now?
Thank you. Oh God. You know? I'm glad you said it so I didn't have to. Okay.
You're good. I mean, I can say it. I can say it. And then let's be real. Half of these dead composers have done very questionable things.
Oh,
you know?
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Yeah. It just, it's so like obscure, like what people are talking about. And so I keep finding this desire to like really demystify when people are like, they've just got the Mozartian line. Like, what does that mean? What?
Yeah.
Who's coming up with these terms? Like, can we actually nail down what we're talking about, or are we all going to pretend like we know exactly what that is? I just feel people are saying terms just to say terms, like just to sound smart. The Academy is
so
annoying. Y'all are annoying. Listeners, y'all are annoying. Anyway, not you, not anybody listening to this podcast,
okay.
But but your colleagues, you know the ones, they're annoying.
No, there's just some unspoken technical things, you know, like, I don't know, if you look at the score, there's not a whole lot of like articulation or musicality behind it, but there's some like, unspoken rules in the piano keyboard world, right? Like 16th notes are always legato, 8th notes are kind of like separated. If you have a longer note, add some sort of embellishment. Like those are just like some basic rules that most everybody knows. You know, you follow the natural act theory dynamics. You don't ever go too overt. Like, it's like basic stuff that every pianist will hear at some point, essentially.
Okay.
So I don't know if it's like Bach specific, but like, it's kind of like across the board, that's how it is, you know?
Now, let's get into listening to the Netherlands Bach Society recording that you sent me. Yes, and we'll talk all about
so
this.
Good. The recording and the video. Oof, so good.
So big variation there as far as like, it feels like we're always like anticipating the next, in this really delicious way, like anticipating the next beat in this recording. So I really, really like that aspect.
Oh, it's a very good performance. I love that performance a lot. It's very good. It's so nice. I mean, and if we're going to be technical, then he's got the most Bach touch because he's playing it on the instrument it's meant for. I mean, let's be real.
That's fair. And going back to what you mentioned earlier, as far as like, what are the differences for the different keyboard instruments? As far as if you're playing it on piano, are you trying to sound like it's a harpsichord? Are you trying to sound like it's for the piano? Are you trying that changing your perception or your technique? That's something that I'd never even thought about because I'm not a pianist. So it's like, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, pianists, we like to use our pedal a lot, right, for like sustaining things and helping with our legato. But like me personally, as a performer, as a pianist, my personal choice is when I'm playing Baroque music, I use the pedal as little as I can, which like in the Bach aria, in this aria, I don't use it at all. If you don't really need it, you know, but like that's one way you can kind of like fake it or fake that harpsichord sound, is to just not use the pedal as much.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
So, but I, you know, I really like that recording because I feel like it sounds, you know, as it should on a harpsichord, right? And like you point out, the tempo is just like delicious. Like there's no other way to put it. Like I could have sent you the Glenn Gould recording, but the Glenn Gould recording is like,
okay, wait, let's talk about this. Cause as soon as I started researching to prepare for this, everybody was like, you gotta listen to the Glenn Gould recordings and the 81 recording and the 50. Right, and I was like, right, wait.
Here's my hot take as a pianist. I think Glenn Gould as a Baroque, as a Bach artist in particular, is very overrated, right? He does whatever the heck he wants with tempo. And like, as much as I'm all for like performer intent, you can't play a gig like it's a funeral march, because sometimes he does that, especially like in his later recordings, but it's tempo. It doesn't matter, right? Martha Argerich can get away with it because she doesn't just do Bach, or she isn't known for Bach. Like Martha Argerich tempo, very quick on everything. Glenn Gould, you never know what you're going to get. Sometimes it's way too slow and sometimes it's way too fast.
Wait, this and I think is he's so overrated. Wild because I was like, well, clearly I have to listen to both of them because everybody's talking about them. I could only find articles about like, because they really like bookended his career, like it seems that his career in general is really synonymous with the Goldberg variation. So I had to listen to both.
He has a
recording in 1955 and then one in 1981. Mm-hmm. And I really liked the 81 version.
I just don't like Gold in general, to be honest. Like I don't, when I want to listen to Bach, I don't go to Gold. I go to Simone Dinnerstein. That's who I go to.
Okay.
she's very good at what she does. Like Gold is fine. Like he has his place. It's also like, I don't know, I'm not a huge fan of it. So like, I agree the 81 recording is better than the 55, but I don't think the 81 recording is as good as any other recording out there. You know, it's not better than anything else.
Ah, listeners, this is spicy today. I was not prepared. My mouth is on fire. This is spicy. Because I actually really liked the 81 recording. But again, I am not a trained pianist, so I don't... Maybe I can't comment on it. But listeners, I would really recommend, if you're interested in reading about Glenn Gould further, there's an MTO article, the Society for Music Theory, their online journal. There's an article by Peter Martins called Glenn Gould's Constant Rhythmic Reference Point, Communicating Pulse in Bach's Goldberg Variations, 1955 and 1981. Mm-hmm. I really liked this article as far as kind of trying to break down Glenn Gould's rhythmic integrity in his recordings of these in the two recordings, and how it changes over time. It has some interviews from him talking about it and how he kind of transformed his thinking over time, or his rhythmic breakdown over time. And I thought that was really interesting, but you know, we don't have to listen to them. Maybe I'll just leave it up to you, listener, if you want to go and check them out.
I think we should listen to them, you know. And like, I like earlier Glenn Gould recordings more than later Glenn Gould recordings. So I think he gets later on in life and he's like, fuck it, I can do what I want. Oh, sorry. He says, screw it, I can do what I want. Because I'm older and I like have established my name and what it is. You know, sometimes performers get away with that because they've done it for so long, they can get away with it.
That is
fair. I feel like that's kind of what he did too, you know?
That is fair.
Thank you.
All right. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, it sounds very beautiful. It sounds very natural. But again, he skips the repeats in that, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas you look at other recordings and they take all the repeats. But Glenn Gould's like, I can do what I want, which is fair. He can do what he wants because he's that good. So just kidding. I mean, yeah, the 81 recording, I like it a lot more than the 55 one, for sure. You know, and I can appreciate, like, there's that natural breath. I feel like everybody who listens to the 81 recording, second measure in, there's just that natural breath everyone has to take with him to even get into that third measure, if that makes sense. Mm. You know, right at the very beginning. Mm. So I can appreciate that, you know, but it's just, yeah, I mean, it's fine, but it's not my go-to.
Okay. So Natalie is saying with her chest, she can play it better than Glenn Gould. All right.
No, oh my God. No. Oh my God. No, definitely not. But I think, yeah, that's why the Goldberg variations really appeals to me, because every performer takes it so differently, because you can't.
Right.
Right? Like, it's not an academic piece. There's not necessarily a skill that Bach is like, focus on this skill in this piece right here. It's like, it's an aria with 30 variations because some dude couldn't fall asleep and he was sad. Like, like that's what it is, you know?
Right. Do you have any really favorite variations that you want to listen to or talk about?
Easy. 4 and 5, back to back. Those two were meant to be played together, for sure. And I love them both. Ooh. 4, I feel like, is just for me kind of tacked on, but 5 is my favorite, but I can't listen to 5 without listening to 4.
Okay.
So if I do end up just picking and choosing variations to play, I'll do 4 and 5 for sure. But I certainly want to do more than just 2.
Wonderful. Okay. So pretty soon, yeah, listeners will be able to listen to Natalie's recordings of the aria and 4
That's
and 5.
Like, oh, yeah. Yeah. That's really exciting part, too, is like going through learning this. I think my original tempo marking I had right in my score, I put like the 8th note, because I set my metronome to the 8th note on this. Is my metronome is 8th note to like 72. And I was pretty content with that. It's a little slower pace, it's nice and calm. And then I listened to more and I'm like, oh, this is lacking that vibrancy that I want from it. And so I bumped it up to 92. And I'm like, there's a vibrancy, but still calm enough to not be so overwhelming. Mm. You know, so my tempos are constantly shifting. The way I'm getting into stuff is constantly changing. So it's a really fun piece to explore as a performer, you know, trying to figure out like, how do I want to do this? You know, so there's no pressure. I mean, there is some pressure, but. You know,
I really like that. There, like you said, there's so much momentum already built into it.
Yeah,
and the way that the line is handed back and forth between the hands, it's just so.
Yeah, that's why I love this variation so much. It's like, it's just for me, when I first listened to it, it caught me out of surprise. Like, oh, the melody has moved to the left hand. Like, that's weird. I mean, it's not weird, but like, that's different. You know. I really, this one's my favorite.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I love the way.
And like, I think that's the other reason I really like it, is that you listen to the aria, if you listen to it for the first time, the way you listen to the aria in the beginning is way different than how you listen and hear it at the end. Because it's gone through 30 different transformations. You have a totally different understanding of the aria right at the end when they play it again at the end. And so that's like really nice. You kind of go through this transformation with these variations. You know, so yeah,
totally.
It's a great piece.
It is a great piece. It's a complete work. Yeah. I love it. Thank you so much for introducing it to me. And that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you so much to Natalie for being on the podcast. Thank you to all of you for listening. Like I mentioned earlier, I will put her Twitch information in the show notes. So make sure you go and you check out her music streams. If you want to get in touch with me about something that I should talk about, anything that I should read or listen to, or you want to be on the podcast yourself, or you know somebody who would make a great guest for the show, please send me an email at herbmusicacademia@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Visit my website, fill out the contact form there, herbmusicacademia.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.